Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order, and we have a very exciting hearing planned this morning with a number of very informative witnesses. And I see that we have been joined by the Secretary of State himself, so would you like to come forward? Actually, hold on just a minute if you can. I'm going to ask the committee administrator to just
open a public hearing.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2082. Ask the committee administrator to briefly summarize what we're looking at.
Chair Rosenbaum, you have the original bill and you have the amendment, the dash one, which we received yesterday afternoon. Would you like me to talk about the original bill or just the amendment?
I think that the amendment replaces the original bill.
The amendment replaces the original bill, so let me go through and explain what I found in that amendment. Compared with the original bill, it retains the requirement that petition signers enter into their own information onto the signature sheet. We have also placed copies of this summary out for people to look at. I'm going to skip the little cites on it, but I'll just explain what the amendment does. It retains the requirement that paid signature gatherers register with the Secretary of State, including a statement acknowledging the chief petitioner liability. It retains the requirement that signature gatherers use original, not copies of covered signature sheets prepared by the Secretary of State. It deletes the training requirement from the original bill, but substitutes an acknowledgement statement regarding understanding of Oregon law. It deletes specific authorization requirement, and it substitutes this is compared with the original bill. It substitutes a registration requirement and statement acknowledging liability from the chief petitioner. It prohibits a person convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft from being paid signature gatherers. It authorizes the BOLI, the Secretary of State, and Attorney General to share information in investigations. It requires initiative petitions containing a summary of the proposed measure prior to being circulated for signatures. This is instead of obtaining the ballot title at the start. It provides that a ballot title may be obtained by early submittal of at least 10% of signatures necessary to qualify for the ballot. It requires chief petitioners to report contribution and expenditure information. It also requires chief petitioners using paid signatures gatherers to maintain a payroll records for review by the Secretary of State, Attorney General, and BOLI. It requires paid signature gatherers to use signature sheets that are of different color from signature sheets used by volunteer signature gatherers. It requires signatures to be witnessed by signature gatherers rather than signed in the presence of, as in the current statutes. And it declares an emergency becoming effective upon passage.
Thank you. And so that is a summary of what we're going to be looking at. I want to just make it clear, we are in a public hearing today, but this will by no means be the last hearing we will have on this bill. So committee members, I know that you have just seen what's a pretty voluminous document. We ourselves just got it last night, too. We'll have plenty of time to take a look at this, talk about it, digest it, and we will not be moving forward until people are comfortable they've had a chance to thoroughly look at this proposal. So, Mr. Secretary of State, would you now like to join us? And thanks so much for being here this morning. I see we have been joined by a legislator. Are you able to hold on for just a moment? Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm fine if you want to.
No, that's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. I wanted to come before you and just let you know that our office has reviewed the Dash 1 amendments, and we're supportive of those amendments. And I wanted to just, I know that my elections director, John Lindbeck, spent quite a bit of time at the last hearing going over most of the proposals in the original House Bill 2082, and I just wanted to touch on the amendments that are, it's kind of like it's all one bill now, I apologize, but the changes that have been proposed to the original 2082 in the Dash 1 amendments. First one was to basically make sure that we're really dealing with a rising issue, which is the whole issue of identity theft, and make sure that those who are who have been convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft are not allowed to collect signatures for a period of 5 years after their conviction. These are paid signature gatherers. In these cases, we're talking about paid signature gatherers. We want to make sure that as voters release their personal information to these gatherers, that the people don't have a criminal record in the gathering. So that's one amendment or change to 2082. I should change my language a little change to 2082 that I think makes a lot of sense, because it really deals with the issue that I think we need to address, which is fraud in the signature collecting situation. Another change in the dash one is that because we now have a centralized voter registration system with a scan of every person's signature in the statewide database, there is no need for a county by county sheet. You don't have to have one county for Coos County and one sheet for Coos County and one sheet for Multnomah County. You can just collect signatures because they're all in a database. So, and that would be that makes a whole lot of sense. And then the third big change is a requirement that people who are the chief, basically requiring the chief petitioner to keep wage records so that we can, in fact, between us and the Bureau of Labor and Industries, be sure that they are, in fact, meeting the requirements, the current requirements the voters enacted to say that you can't pay by the signature, you have to pay by the hour. And so this would require them to keep those wage records so that they could be inspected by the Bureau of Labor and Industries or the Secretary of State. And those are the three big changes. And I just want to emphasize that I just wanted to appear very briefly this morning and say we think those changes make a lot of sense and move us further in the direction of really controlling fraud, particularly in the paid signature gathering arena. And that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much for those comments. Are there any questions? Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I'd like to let the Secretary of State go if we're going to have a chance to talk to Mr. Lindbeck later.
Yes, I'm sure we will.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Yes. Well, thank you very much
for being
here this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your courtesy.
And we have a few witnesses that there still is a sign-up sheet out there for anybody in the audience that hasn't signed up and wishes to testify, but we have a couple of people who are under some time constraints, and so I think next we will call Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner. Senator Atkinson, would you like to come forward now? Are you here to testify? Or okay. After this? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And like Secretary Bradbury, our office has reviewed the Dash 1 amendments and certainly are supportive of those amendments, particularly in two areas. First is the record keeping. These are very unique employer-employee relationships for signature gathering firms that have a tendency to travel from state to state, unlike other businesses in the state that establish themselves and stay for a long period of time. To be able to have those records and be able to do a very rapid investigation upon complaint and be able to establish that the employees of these signature gathering firms are properly being paid according to those agreements is absolutely vital and critical to us. And certainly on number eight, to be able to have the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Attorney General, and the Secretary of State be able to share information and clarify that law that we, in fact, can to do a coordinated investigation. When you have different departments that have different authorities, we need that protection as well. Just want to say we're very supportive of the bill. I think there's some great reforms in this particular package, and be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you for being here. Thanks for those comments. Are there any questions for Commissioner Gardner? Representative Thatcher.
I do. Thank you. Commissioner Gardner, I heard you say that you needed quick access to records when you get a complaint. Now, as I understand it, employers really don't get to know who's complaining about them. So how do you know, or how do you know it's not politically driven? I mean, you know, you got this opponent to this measure, you know, throwing out complaints just to throw them off. I can just see that happening. You got enemies out there, you know.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, for one, the employer does get to know when there's a complaint. We send out an immediate demand letter.
But not who?
Well, actually, they can have a copy of the complaint, and the complaint is signed by the complainant, so they know exactly who's complaining. And we don't accept complaints from the opposing people of the measure. We only accept complaints from employees of the signature-gathering firm that contest that they were not paid appropriate wages. Once they have signed a complaint form, that is a public record, and any employer can request that public record.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thanks very much for being here. And next, Senator Atkinson. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Stembridge. For the record, my name's Jason Atkinson, State Senator from District 2, Southern Oregon. And I have to tell you, I get very nostalgic on this issue, and also before this committee, this was one of my first and favorite committees when I served in the House. And there's a character that runs around the building occasionally, now going by his civilian name of Terry Thompson, who taught me how to and schooled me in the finer arts of presenting minority reports right here in this building. So it's a lesson I've learned. Thank you very much for allowing me to walk and testify, and I have not read the entirety of the bill. But I will say I thought I would just offer an opinion that I don't think gets brought up too often in this debate, especially as you're going to be taking testimony for several more days, it sounds like, and trying to put an entire reform bill together. Foremost, let me say that Oregon, if you look back about 100 years ago during what was called in American history the Progressive Movement, Oregon and Wisconsin were really the leads, soulmates, as it were, on the Progressive Movement, which led to the initiative process. And the initiative process was really allowing the people to come on level par with a government that they didn't trust. And at that time, there were three major issues that were happening at the time. It was before World War I, and you had women's suffrage. You had a thing where lobbyists working for the railroads could command the legislature on who was going to be the next United States senator. United States senators in Oregon, and I say that very, please allow, I'm giving a 50,000, 100,000 foot view. But it was, at the time, it was highly charged who would become United States senator. It also led to a thing called workers' comp. Those three issues in particular are birthed right out of the initiative process. And so I come to you at least with one observation by saying that I am particularly very uncomfortable with anything that's going to make it harder to collect signatures under the guise or the rules that we've created to put those signatures in place. It was in the late 1960s, I believe, and forgive me if I have my dates a little bit wrong, but there was a attorney general and there was a secretary at the state at the time who implied a rule that is in a direct competition and direct reflection of what you're debating before this bill under what we call reform. And what had happened is by administrative rule there was a placement on the initiative process that set a timeline of how long a signature would be valid for. So as you move that now 40 years later, which sounds strange to say because when I first started talking about it, it was 30 years later, but 40 years later, what has happened is we have shortened timelines through challenging ballot titles, through all the politics of ballot title shopping, and we have forced the process into, in many times, a industry of paid signature gatherers that most people aren't very uncomfortable with for a whole variety of reasons. But we have stopped the people's ability to let ideas percolate, say, for 2 years. If a ballot title, if a signature would be valid for up to 2 years, you would take that pressure away. And in my mind, you would also take a lot of the politics away of collecting signatures in a rush to beat it before somebody at an executive level is uncomfortable with it and tries to play games with it. Now, that's, you know, this week, this year, one particular party is in charge of the executive and the legislative. But if that were to change, what we would also want is fair treatment under the law as to qualifications of signatures. And so I'd be delighted to share more. I've got a bill on the subject. You're willing. I'd be more than happy to give that to you as a committee bill. But I think as you have a discussion on reform and you have a discussion regarding making it more difficult to collect signatures, we should look at the pressure that's put upon signature initiatives that should be something pure, truly. It's become an industry in Oregon largely because of the rules that we've created for it. We purposely have made it so difficult in a relatively inexpensive media market where national things are tested here, which is really bad. I mean, I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat or Independent. That's not right. But what we've done with our mutual disgust of that is we've made it harder for real citizens to use the tool that is a real huge part of Oregon history. So I would leave you with this. One, take a real long look at taking the pressure away that forces paid signature gathers, which I believe is creating a window between when your ballot is given and how long your signatures are valid. I think that would be a good part of reform as you're talking about it. Madam Chair, thank you very much, and it's good to be over here. I hope nobody minority reports.
We shall see. Well, thank you, Senator, for those comments. And I just want to say, speaking for myself, that I am by no means trying to take away anybody's rights to use the initiative process. I believe that this is a valid part of our process that enables citizens to move ideas forward, and so I think what we're trying to do is take a look at how that can work best and any changes that might be needed to ensure the integrity of the process. That's really what we're about here. So,
Madam Chair, thank you. I think as we look at it, though, there's such a huge Oregon history to it. That there has been, I mean, we would all argue, we can all verify that there has been attacks to the system and all the politics of politics, which personally I don't have much of an appetite for these days. But that was standing. I think if you look at that one rule that happened in about 40 years ago, I think, and you apply that rule to how the Supreme Court is involved in ballot titles, you could get to reform, make it easier for people, and take the industry of it out. Not that it's a silver bullet, but it's certainly a platinum one.
Thank you. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, thank you. I appreciate your approach to this. And I would, if it's all right, let's see a copy of the bill you're
sure.
proposing. Thank
you.
You
bet. Members, thank you very much.
Yes,
Doctor, good to see you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for returning to the legislature.
And we have both Senator George and Representative Greenlick. Senator George, would it be all right if we have Representative Greenlick come forward? Thank you. Please join us.
Oh, we'll be able to hear.
The things he'll do to make a dramatic entrance. That's true.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland West. And I'm very, very happy to be here. I appreciate the work you're doing on this bill, which I think is a very significant bill. And I just thought I'd like to take the opportunity to make a couple of comments. I had the fascinating experience of trying to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot without having $500,000 in advance to do it, and it gave me a great deal of insight into the process and into some notions about how the process could be changed to help things along. I'm a very strong supporter of the Oregon system. I think initiative, referendum, and recall is critical to our citizens feeling a part of the process. And we led the way, as if I remember my history correctly, we in Wisconsin were very early in the 20th century to implement that into our state processes. And when my constituents call me and tell me, you got to stop this business, we can't stand 30 initiatives on the ballot or whatever it was a couple of years ago, I've resisted that, and I've really told them that the citizens need the opportunity to speak. But it's clear to me that the process has been distorted by money, and it's been bifurcated into kind of two streams. One stream is citizens working together on their own, gathered together, and to try and put issues on the ballot, either as statutory or as constitutional amendments, and then special interest groups, which could be individuals or other kinds of special interest groups, simply bringing money to the table and showering money into the process, and then using that as a way of getting their ability to express their opinion. Now, we have freedom of speech, and political money is speech, and I understand that quite well, but it seems to me the process is being distorted, and it seems to me as well what we need to do is to make life easier for individual citizens working together, groups of citizens working together to try and get measures on the ballot, whether they be referenda or initiatives, and not necessarily make it easier for out-of-state interests with a big pot of money to influence Oregon political and social life in a way that's so significant. There are some things in your bill that are very important, and let me just share my frustrations of the process of trying to get 145,000 signatures or so in order to get 101,000 valid signatures to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. If I had had somebody that had handed me a check for $500,000 before I started, or if I had had $500,000 of my own money, Harriet wouldn't let me use that much money. If I had $500,000 of my own money, life would have been easier. I'd have started very early. I'd have hired people. I'd have gotten them lined up early, and I'd have sat back and watched the process and started writing my voters' pamphlet statements. Or I'd have tried several options to make sure that I got a ballot title that I liked. So I'd have tried 10 or 15 ballot titles until I found the one I liked, and then shower the money onto the process. But citizens don't really have the opportunity to do that. It's complicated enough to get one initiative and one ballot title, and then it's very complicated, even when you raise money along the way. And eventually, I was able to raise about $300,000 in the process, but it happened because of you know, individuals us working on it. It was very late in the process. So we had a sort of bifurcated system where, as we got money, we were able to hire signature gatherers, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, and then we had a big volunteer effort going on at the same time. I'm a statistician in some sense, and I learned about the theory of large numbers, but it had never occurred to me how large a number 145,000 was when you tried to get that many valid that many signatures on a petition sheet. In order to get 101,000 valid, which is what we estimated we need to do, and that probability was about right. We gathered 116,000, which ended up with less than 90,000 valid signatures for that, and we failed to get on the ballot. But as I watched the process, there were some things that were very clear to me, and one item of the bill in front of you is a really very important one. In fact, I have a bill of my own that I've introduced, or that I will introduce on this, but I think it will be taken care of by the omnibus bill you're working on. And that's the question of getting single counties on a single signature sheet. And there was nothing more frustrating than one of my volunteers sent in a signature sheet that had 6 signatures from Multnomah County, 3 signatures from Washington County, and 1 from Clackamas County. And that meant that we had a cross out, essentially, 4 out of 10 signatures from people who legitimately signed the petition and wanted their signatures named. And I understand what the need for that has been in the past, but it is clear now that that's not necessary with a central voters registration file. The Secretary of State, it is not necessary for the county clerks to be validating all those things. It's far more efficient, far less expensive if it's done centrally. And then the notion that a single signature sheet has to only contain signatures from a single county can go away. And I hope that after the bill passes, the Secretary of State, of course, will create rules that will go with that and allow signature sheets from multiple counties. My friends who were helping me down in Southern Oregon had that same kind of problem with Jackson County and Josephine County, and then somebody would go over to the beach and pick up a couple from Coos County, and they'd all be on the same sheet. Incidentally, we sent out to volunteers about 200,000 signature sheets to get them back. The deadline was when July 1st of 2006, we got a signature sheet last week. They still are coming back. It doesn't surprise us. Every week we pick up the mail and here's another signature sheet. So, when you're working with volunteers, it's a very complicated issue. The other thing that was very frustrating, and which I hope you think about as you're amending this bill and working it through the process, was the fact that a lot of signature sheets are thrown away for are essentially eliminated for sort of technical things. For example, we had hundreds of sheets that came back with one person's signatures on it because we mailed it out. They filled it out, they signed it, but they did something wrong in attesting to their signature on the bottom. Now, it seems to me if a petition has only one person's signature on it, that ought to be the attestation that the signature is correct. So we ended up in the process mailing sheets back. Somebody would send us a sheet that had one signature or maybe a husband and wife signature, but the bottom attesting the signature either wouldn't be filled out or it wouldn't have a date on it or something would be wrong, and we would use a 39-cent stamp and a 39-cent return stamp to mail it back to them to get them to sign the bottom to attest that their signature was really their signature. I mean, we need to get some rationality into this process, and we would have a signature sheet. I mean, this was so frustrating because Harry and I basically handled every single signature sheet that came in. We logged it in and put it in the computer, and we looked at every one. And here would be a signature sheet that would come that would have 10 signatures on it. They would be dates from July 1st to July 30th on the signature sheet, and the person who had signed the sheet signed it July 1st because that's when they started gathering signatures. Now, it was signed July 1st. It was attested to a person. They were on the sheet. It was the first date, and either we had to throw that sheet away or hope that this wouldn't be one that was picked up in the audit of the Secretary of State, or we had to send it back and get them to change the date. Well, if they changed the date and initialed the change, that threw the whole sheet out, because the only way you could do it was to re-sign the whole thing. We tried to explain what happened, re-sign the whole thing and put a new date, and then the Secretary of State would accept it. Well, I mean, it seems to me the process ought to assure that every legitimate Oregon citizen who signed a petition sheet ought to be able to have their signature counted. And the rules ought not eliminate. I mean, in our case, I think from 116,000 to 88,000, 28,000 signatures were thrown out for one reason or another. Some of them for valid reasons. They couldn't validate the signature. But I think the Secretary of State took 6,000 signatures off the top for things like date flaws or the fact that people had initialed things rather than signing them or things like that. And that, I mean, somewhere in the process, we ought to be doing something to strengthen that. So I really do, I think amendments and where you're going with this bill is absolutely in the right direction. I really applaud you for what you're doing, and I encourage you to keep doing it. And remember, the thing is to help citizens who are trying to get these things on the ballot, help them achieve it in ways that are appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlich, I'm wondering, as someone who ran a mostly volunteer campaign, there's a provision in the amendments that would require initiative campaigns to receive their signature sheets from the Secretary of State's office. In one part, it seems very positive that there would be a template created. I have a concern over the sequential numbering of petition sheets. Did you find in your campaign that you were making copies of petition sheets in order to get them out to people who were gathering signatures for you? And do you have any concern about having to stick with sequential numbered sheets?
Well, one of the problems is we were making copies, but so was everybody else that happened to get a sheet. So we found people making copies and not copying it. And I mean, if it wasn't copied exactly right with the margins exactly right and everything like the Secretary of State would delete it. And particularly if only the front of the sheet was copied and not the back, we got rather skillful at Xeroxing the back of the sheet on if that happened. But absolutely. I mean, we would get a call from Southern Oregon saying we need 1,000 sheets by Monday. And we had some friends who would let us use high-speed Xerox machines, and we knew how to do it. And we would just, you know, run down somewhere, Xerox, Harry and I, Xerox 1,000 or 2,000 sheets and put them on the bus to Medford. I mean, that happened all the time. And I mean, it would have taken some more management, but it would seem to me it certainly complicates things if you need to. I mean, and we would get them printed in boxes of 10,000. We'd always have a box of 10,000, but an extra box of 10,000 sheets, but then they'd be gone, and we'd run down and Xerox them. Yeah, I think it would be a problem, but it would also, I think, well, no, I mean, you can't give instructions to anybody that they'll understand. People have extraordinary ability to distort whatever it was you just told them that you can. I think that would be a problem, but on the other side, I mean, maybe it would be the right thing to do.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Representative Greenlich, the previous person, Senator Atkinson, had talked about having the ability to extend the time, especially for these volunteer signatures to be valid for a period, he was saying up to 2 years, which might give the chance for citizen petitioners to actually keep working their citizen petition instead of having to use paid signatures. Have you thought about that, or was that something that would make any sense to you, or do you think the time limits are pretty reasonable?
Well, I think it would have been extraordinary if I could have kept the 116,000 I had and just moved to the 2008 ballot and kept gathering signatures. That actually never occurred to me, but I think that would be quite extraordinary. I think it might make some complications, but so before I really recommend it, I have to think about it. But it would have been wonderful if we could have just kept going. And I suppose that's what would happen under what you're talking about.
So.
I mean, if we did have 85,000 valid signatures, we'd have only needed another 30 or 40,000, which would have been pretty easy to get. And it would have been great to be able to keep going and put it on the 2008 ballot.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Roland asked my question, but I do appreciate your testimony, Representative Greenlich. Thank you.
I would say it was an experiment that was worth doing, but it was what the psychologists call a one trial learning experience. That's something we want to do again.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate having the opportunity.
And next, Senator George, would you like to come forward?
You're right to be cautious, Senator.
Do you have a license for the
whole? I have a license.
Good morning.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me the latitude to come in and address the committee on an important issue. And I share so many of the comments that Representative Greenlich and Senator Atkinson said. It is so true, the problems we had with signature drives.
Could you please identify?
I'm sorry. think I'd get used to that kind of thing, wouldn't you? I'm Larry George, State Senator from Senate District 13. One of the things that is a little bit about my background is that at Oregon State, one of my majors was political science, and my senior paper coming out of Oregon State was how bad direct democracy was and how the initiative process corrupted our Republican form of government. Little did I know, after spending a couple sessions in State Capitol, how wrong you can be in your youth. As some of you may know, I've been involved in the initiative process for some time, and I think the frustration that people have is that we've been forced to use paid petitioners primarily because of the fact that it is very, very difficult to gather signatures with volunteers for a lot of the reasons that Representative Greenlit just pointed out. I mean, the fact is that when we did a study in about 1998, we were finding at the time the price for paid signatures were about $1.25, and the price for us to gather volunteer signatures were about $3.50. It was over double the cost. And part of the reason is that the rules are very complex. I remember in about third grade, my teacher had us all explain how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and how difficult that was to explain a simple task like making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and try explaining how to fill out one of those forms to the citizens, especially when it comes to the dates and where you sign and how many, and the fact that the one signer may have to sign it twice. And so what we end up doing is sending volunteer signatures back and forth between the signers and the campaign. And what we found is it was much easier just to hire a paid signature firm to do it because it was cheaper. And so we lost that citizen involvement because you just could not afford to do it through volunteers with the way the complex rules are currently are with filling out the sheets. And I would ask as you go forward is that realize that people who have the moneyed interest will always have enough money, no matter how complex we make the system, to get through the system. If we make the system more complex, what it does is makes it harder for grassroots organizations to gather those signatures, because every time the law gets more complex, it really does make it more expensive to interact with the citizens. And that was basically my comments, and I think Representative Greenlit really summed up a lot of my experience with the problems with being on the campaign of dealing with volunteers. So with that, I'd be available for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator. I think you bring up a very valid point. The more complexity that's entered into this system, the more that big money will have the opportunity to wade through it, whereas the people in the state of Oregon, it's going to be more of a difficult challenge for them to succeed at this. And that is one thing I do not want us to do. This initiative process has to be open to grassroots effect, grassroots effort. And more importantly, the citizenry of this state needs to have some sort of a venue and some sort of a vehicle in order to have their voice heard by this Capitol. So I agree with you.
Chair and Representative, if I could, I will tell you I've been on both campaigns, ones where we had very little money and volunteers, and ones where we had a lot of money and didn't need volunteers. And I will tell you which one is easier, and I will tell you which one is cheaper. It is the one where you have lots of money, and that seems to be a big tragedy, because what we've done is made this process so complex with these rules and these requirements that it is just easier to have money and pay somebody to take care of it and take the risk and take all the responsibility than it is to try to take that on yourself. And I think your point is very well taken.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Looks like you answered everybody's questions. Thank you for being here.
Appreciate it.
And next, I'm going to call Phil Schradl from the Attorney General's office.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. And Chair Rosenbaum, thank you very much for accommodating my schedule. I can't be available for Friday or Monday's hearings, and so I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today. I want to focus my comments on what originally was House Bill 2081, which got rolled into House Bill 2082. And the provisions primarily start at Section 10 of the dash one amendments of 2082. And I want to focus my comments on the ballot title process under current law and how it would be amended if House Bill 2082-1 were to be enacted. And under current statutory provisions, 25 signatures are what it takes to trigger the ballot title process. And there are a couple of perverse effects of that. One, because it is so easy, it is very easy to trigger that ballot title process numerous times. And what the other kind of perverse piece of the current system is that once the ballot title has been process has been started, that what happens is it comes over to our office for the drafting of a draft ballot title, and then goes out for comments, and then comes back for a certified ballot title, which is subject to judicial review in the Oregon Supreme Court. While that ballot title process is ongoing, no one can go out and gather signatures until the certified ballot title has either been not challenged or approved by the Supreme Court. That adds an incentive for people to challenge every single ballot title that gets drafted by our office. And the statistics that I have set out in my written testimony attest to that. And what it also has, and I would characterize this also as a perverse effect, is a number of those cases are litigated all the way through the Oregon Supreme Court on measures that, once they get approved for signature gathering, never go out and get signatures, and either are never going to get enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. So what the current system does is focus ballot title litigation at the very front end of the system in a way that we think is very ineffective, both for cost purposes and for signature gathering purposes. The primary changes that would be enacted, were House Bill 2082-1 to be enacted, would be that our office, once a filed measure was filed with the Secretary of State, would come to our office for an initiative petition summary, a 75-word summary that we would be charged with accurately and impartially characterizing the major effects of the proposal. That would go through a comment period and come back to our office for the issuance of a final petition summary. We've taken out a judicial review component of that because of the perverse effect of all the litigation that occurs and holds up signature gathering. Our proposal would be that all of the signatures would then be gathered with that initiative petition summary, and there would be no holdup at any point of the process for signature gathering. People could gather from the time our final petition summary was drafted all the way through, even during the period that any litigation over the ballot title would occur. Consequently, there's a very advantageous piece of this for chief petitioners in terms of getting things on the ballot. There wouldn't be a hiatus of a few months or 6 months waiting for a Supreme Court decision to get a certified ballot title to gather signatures. They'd be able to gather signatures. When the chief petitioners had gathered 10% or more of the signatures to qualify it for the ballot, they would file those signatures with the Secretary of State's office. Secretary of State would simply verify the number of signatures, not whether they were valid signatures, but verify that 10% of the number of signatures to qualify it for the ballot had been filed with the Secretary of State's office. At that point in time, if the chief petitioners wished to, they could then trigger the ballot title process. And then the ballot title process would go through the normal course of how the ballot title process is conducted right now. There would be no difference in it. It would just happen at a later point in time. Now, you probably will hear some people say that, well, the ballot title is the most important marketing tool that's out there. Well, I think there's a philosophical question about what the grassroots purpose behind the initiative process is. Is it a ballot title, or is it the policy that's embedded in the proposal? The current system makes people generate 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 different little tweaks, not because of policy choices so much, but because of their marketing tool about the ballot title. And that I don't think is the right way to have the train run. I think the legal policies that are significant, the legal policy choices that people want to present through the initiative process are what should drive the system rather than the marketing tool of a ballot title. Now, people will have every right under the proposal to challenge the ballot titles just as they currently do, and it does not mean that any additional signatures need to be gathered because there's no change to the signature gathering requirement, so it doesn't make it harder to qualify anything for the ballot. What it does is it focuses the ballot title litigation process on those measures that have one, and exhibited an ability to actually reach the ballot, and it does so at a time that I think will take out the perverse incentive to challenge the ballot title because it won't hold up signature gathering in the process. So we think there are a number of advantages for everybody in the system because of this. It will say, it might not save, frankly, our office much money or time because we'll be doing the initiative petition summaries as well as the ballot title drafting and defense. I think it will save chief petitioners money, opponents to the chief petitioners, and the court system a tremendous amount of time, energy, and effort that gets expended on matters that are never likely or even maybe intended to reach the ballot. It actually addresses a bit of what Senator Atkinson was talking about in terms of a period of time for signatures to be valid. There are some difficulties about extending the time that that signatures can be valid because if you lap over into a subsequent election cycle, there could be very much voter confusion about how if a similar measure is circulated for the 2008 cycle that was circulated during the 2006 cycle, have I signed that already? Which and not knowing which election is going to be on, there's some administrative difficulties about that. But our proposal would actually help because it would allow the signature gathering to occur beginning on a date certain. The chief petitioners would know when signature gathering could occur, calculated out from when they file it with the Secretary of State, rather than the current uncertainty with the Supreme Court challenge. And it would not have a hiatus on signature gathering pending the litigation over the ballot title. So we think there are many advantages for everybody concerned in the system and would encourage that piece of the proposal to go forward. We filed a similar measure over on the Senate side that I understand is going to be focused on here. So with that, I'm be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. This shifts the litigation part to the end, and I understand that. But if it takes a long time to get those signatures, when you get those signatures, you may be running up against the election. And then how long do you have to actually, I mean, you're going to have to build in a time frame for litigation, and you may not know how long that's going to take.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin. The proposal would be that any time after you've gathered 10% of the signatures to qualify for the ballot, you could request a ballot title by filing those with the Secretary of State. Currently, the signature filing deadline for all of the signatures to require to qualify something for the ballot would be in July.
Okay.
The ballot title wouldn't actually be, you know, published in the voter's pamphlet until a significant amount of time after that. There could be some squeeze in the system if chief petitioners did not file their 10% of their signatures sometime in advance. If everybody waited until July, there could be, you know, a kind of a bottleneck potentially, but I think there will be enough incentive on the part of chief petitioners to get a ballot title, to know what their ballot title ultimately will be, that I think people won't delay until the last minute.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wanting to make sure I'm reading your testimony correctly. You talk about the cost, and this is just the cost to the Department of Justice, doesn't count any of the Secretary of State costs related to processing petitions. But $229,000 in 0305, and then you talk about the fact that was just for 0305, that the numbers for the last election cycle, that the number of proposed initiative measures was even higher. But am I reading this correct in terms of the 2008 cycle, that there have already been 66 initiative petitions filed for the November 2008 election as of last month?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, those figures are accurate. In fact, in the it was an unbelievable start with about 35 measures being filed very early in the system, and we are running significantly higher than the last biennium. I'd like to add one more comment. I believe that Bill Sizemore testified before this committee last week on just initiative matters in general, and saying that part of the current system and actually a rationale or reason why some people file numerous measures to get different ballot titles or not different ballot titles may be to get some advice from our office about what the actual effect of the proposed measure is, and they may react to that when they get the ballot title. Under our proposal, the initiative petition summary would serve the exact same function. We would give a 75-word, impartial, accurate statement of what we understood the measure to do. And so that piece of whatever efficacy there is in that would not be lost under our proposal as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would it be fair to say that if we don't do something to reform this biotitle shopping process, that when we look at your 07-09 budget figures, that this 229,000 is going to be chump change? It's going to be significantly higher than that if we don't do something to correct the situation.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, I believe that the figures over the last three election cycles were for the 2000 election cycle, the 2002 election cycle, and the 2004 election cycle, the numbers were a slight bit higher than they were for the 2006 election cycle. 2006 was a little bit lower than prior cycles. 2008 seems to be running ahead of the curve in terms of recent history.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just curious as to why 10% was arrived at as a number of required signatures.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, there is no magic to 10%. That is a considered opinion about what would be an appropriate requisite showing of significant seriousness and possibility of it appearing on the ballot. Some figure would, right now, 25 is all that's required. Our suggestion was 10% of those required. There have been other suggestions in the past that were 2,500 signatures. You know, some that is simply, you know, a guesstimate about what would be an appropriate matter for this body to choose as the appropriate target.
And Vice Chair Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure, thank you for your testimony. I guess I have just a political question for you, because this is a political process. When you mention the marketing aspect of ballot titles, it does have a tremendous impact on the potential success or failure of the initiative. Do you have any information on how other states with initiative processes might work with petitioners on their ballot titles, so to get out of this system that I agree is not working well for us, but also addresses the really real political reality that a bad ballot title can by itself sink your initiative?
I'm Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley. I'm not aware of myself personally about how other states approach it. There is information out there. I believe there's a national entity that deals with initiative referendum that would be a resource that we could look to find out potentially. In terms of the marketing itself, my point earlier about the policy that's embodied in the proposal should be what drives whether it's a good idea or not. The statutory requirements about how the ballot title is to be drafted, you know, provide that it's to be an accurate, impartial statement of the major effects of the proposal. The ballot title gets driven by the policy that's being put forward, and, you know, whether, you know, our office is drafting it or somebody else's office is drafting it or the chief petitioners are drafting it, I think what you want to have is not a marketing tool. I think what you want to have is an accurate piece of information for the voters to make an informed judgment about whether they should support the policy that's being put forward to them or not. Not this is apple pie and motherhood, or this is no more taxes forever. That's not what should drive the debate, and the information that should be provided to the voters is exactly what the statute calls for.
Well, I've noticed inability for how things should be and how politics are. There's a kind of gap in between those. And I think we'll have other people testify on this, on how that does impact. And so I hope you'll be open to possibly different ideas of how that might work.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, absolutely.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. It was just occurring to me as you were talking about the getting initiative petition summaries and how many ballot titles have been sought for this year so far. And I'm wondering, would you then have a glut of, instead of 66 ballot titles to work on, would you have a glut of 66 initiative petition summaries to work on instead?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, yes, we might well. That's why I'm saying I don't know that it ends up being a cost savings, particularly to our office, what it is going to be a cost savings to the chief petitioners, the opponents of the measure, the court system. I think that, but in some ways, I think it will take out the litigiousness of the ballot title process itself, because it will only be on those that have shown that they are headed towards the ballot. There will be a significantly smaller number of those, so the litigation that's associated with the current process, I think, will be negated to some to substantial degree.
Other one? Yes, follow up. I guess so. Somebody spends a bunch of money trying to get 10,000 signatures. It apparently has legs. It gets submitted to your office, and yeah, I think there'd be a lot of. I mean, if somebody's worried about this getting on the ballot, there'll be a lot of litigation, I would imagine. I just can't imagine that it would save the chief petitioners much money, because you're still having to go through the process of gathering this 10,000 signatures and then going into a battle about the ballot title later.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, yes, once the 10% signature threshold is reached, I think there will be incentive on both sides to litigate the ballot title at that point in time. But we now have ballot title litigation on matters that are never circulated for signature gathering after the ballot title litigation's over. And the figures in my written testimony, there were 76 ballot title review proceedings, and then only 6 of those received enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, and only 26 of those ever were pushed back to the Secretary of State to get approval even to gather signatures. So there were 50, you know, Supreme Court proceedings that occurred on measures that were never even circulated for signatures.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing the conversation as we move forward. Thank you.
And next I'll call Jeff Leahy. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Leahy. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, and I'm also a trooper with the Oregon State Police, and I have been so for the last 20 years. During my career, I've conducted many investigations of forgery and identity theft. This is a crime that is growing across the nation and worldwide. But also, personally, I'm in favor of the initiative process. But I'm here to speak in favor of the provision of House Bill 2082 that bans those convicted of forgery or identity theft in the previous 5 years from gathering signatures. Based on my experience with investigating identity theft, this is a good change to Oregon's signature gathering laws. ID theft was an issue that could not have been foreseen when this process was started. In my experience, people have a propensity for identity theft will use any means they can for obtaining personal information. They are con artists. Imagine a circulator stopping a senior citizen on the street, getting them to sign their page, then telling them they need to see some identification in order to verify their signature. 10 seconds or less, they'll get everything they need to steal their identity. And it may be weeks or months before the victim realizes that it's happened. As you know, in Oregon, identity theft is often connected with drug use and methamphetamine addiction. These people are caught in a cycle of addiction and will do anything to feed the habit. And signature gathering, which is often paid by cash in some of the less reputable companies, is a too perfect way for them to finance their addiction. Stolen identities are also sold through other criminals. With this bill, we can shut off that cash pipeline while helping to protect the citizens of Oregon from fraud. And it just makes common sense that the people with forgery or identity theft convictions shouldn't be engaged in work that gives them access to signatures of Oregon citizens or puts them in a situation where they are asking voters for information. Identity thieves and forgers could make a good living gathering signatures, and while all petition sheets are public information already, it is difficult and expensive to get copies of the sheets from the Secretary of State. It's much easier to pick up a part-time job, get some signatures on one initiative, and then forge them onto a petition of another. It's common practice to prevent people convicted of a crime participating in activities related to that crime for a period of time. I think 5 years is a fair amount of time to give someone a chance to turn their life around. I know of one case in particular, a young woman that I arrested numerous times, who, when she was in the throes of her addiction, financed it by theft, ID theft, and forgery. I wouldn't have trusted her to gather signatures. But now, more than 5 years later, she's cleaned herself up, gainfully employed, and would be a good employee to anyone. But it took a long time, and it would have been unreasonable to put her back in situations that could have compromised her before she had proven to herself and others that she could make a go of life free from crime. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Represented quite a few, I see. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. I'm just wondering, maybe you can take me through the process. How would somebody go about finding out somebody has a background in forgery or whatever? I mean, is that something they would go to the state police for, and how much would that cost?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher. Currently, there are many organizations that require a background check. Real estate agents, for one. Youth Activities League, almost all of them require their coaches now and people that come in contact with children on a regular basis to have a general background check before they can volunteer. I'm not sure of the cost. At one time, I remember it was $5. It could be as much as $15 now to go and get your fingerprints taken and get your criminal history and provide it with them. And they'll give you a copy to provide to your employer.
Representative Hunt, did you have a question? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. If I understand this correctly, and Mr. Stembridge can correct me if I'm wrong, this would only apply to paid signature gatherers.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, that's my understanding.
And so there is a hole big enough to drive a trooper's car through here. We are checking on paid signature gatherers, but there's nothing that would prevent unpaid signature gatherers from access to exactly the same information through the same process.
Joe Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, I would have no problem with everybody going through the same process.
I understand that. I understand that. Thank you.
I just would respond, though, that I think the problems we have heard about have been mostly, and I don't think we've really heard much testimony that there have been problems with volunteer signature gatherers, but I'm sure there will be people in the audience that can tell us about that, too. Okay, any other questions? I see none, so thank you very much for being here. And next, I will call Kevin Mannix. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem, a former five-term member of the House and partial-term member of the Senate, and also a chief petitioner on a number of ballot measures over the years, mostly successful, some of which involved the use of volunteers and some of which involved the use of paid signature gatherers. And this goes back to actually 1990 when I first became involved in the initiative process. I come to you today as a citizen involved in this process, and I have checked the opposed box as to the proposed legislation because I believe that by and large the balance of the legislation doesn't go in the right direction. But I do believe that there are appropriate issues that need to be addressed in this process. What I ask the committee to do is to take a step back and consider first the history of the Oregon system. And that's what I didn't really present testimony today. I've turned in 25 copies of a short piece I wrote in December, which outlines the initiative, referendum, and recall process, which belong to the citizens, and the referral process, which is really a partnership between the legislature and the citizens, where the legislature asks citizens to either take action on a constitutional amendment or revision or a statute. In that piece, I point out that while the legislature was maligned somewhat in recent years for sometimes doing statutory referrals, that the reason for those statutory referrals was that the legislature had an unfortunate experience of getting 212 vetoes from Governor Kitzhaber, and found that on some issues where they thought the public were in agreement with the majority of the House and Senate, they might as well send it there rather than to the governor's office for a veto. I just mentioned that parenthetically. The legislature, too, has used this process as a means of getting things done when they found an obstacle in what I'll call the regular legislative process. But what I want to drive home at the beginning this morning is that this process is something that was devised by Oregonians a little over 100 years ago, as direct democracy because the citizens of Oregon claimed ownership of their government. And in partnership with the legislature at the time, which had to refer out the necessary constitutional amendments to change things, the people of this state set up a new kind of democratic slash republican government, which has sometimes had difficulties and sometimes has, I think, saved us from ourselves, and other times been wonderfully successful. It has the same kind of mixed record as any democratic system will have. It is imperfect, and as long as we are human, it will continue to be imperfect. What we can strive to do is to improve it, to refine it, and to make it work better. But let's never kid ourselves that anything, whether it's the legislative process through Republican representation, as with a small r, or the direct democracy process, neither of those processes will ever work perfectly. We'll just keep working at making it better. I want to put that context in front of you because we were the national leaders in developing the initiative, the referendum and the recall. Other states followed. But we sit here today in a nation where almost half the states still don't have those rights, most of them east of the Mississippi. We take these things for granted, and sometimes we need to revisit the principles on which these things are involved. And I wanted to set the stage with these preliminary remarks because you are dealing with something which is very fragile in some respects, but also very solid in other respects. It's solid in terms of the principle that the citizens of the state own their government. It is fragile in the sense that there are those who will abuse the systems that we set up for their own ends, and we know that. And we have to try to refine the system, to try to protect against those abuses, while at the same time empowering the people to be able to speak for themselves. Now, here are some of the things that I think need to be considered in terms of the original bill and now as amended with the set of amendments that are in front of you. One, what are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to achieve better citizen access to this system? If we are, why have we just slammed the door on internet access to petition circulation? If we want to make sure the forms are perfect and the information is perfect, why aren't we using the system that the IRS uses more than anything else now to get forms out to the public on the most complicated things in our lives, our taxes? This past weekend, I had access to that system, and I could download the exact format necessary for IRS forms. Or, of course, I could file electronically. But in our initiative process, we've turned our backs on that opportunity, which would allow more volunteerism in the system than ever before. Why can't you log on to a website and say, you know, I like that petition, and I want to sign it and mail it in and download it, print it out on your computer, sign the thing, and make it a self-attestation signature in that kind of case so it's not too complicated, and send it in. That should be one of the things that's being considered here, because that will encourage volunteerism. In fact, we could prohibit web pages from charging a Visa fee or a MasterCard fee in order to be able to access this petition. Mail it in. Now, in terms of the process, watch out for the games that are played on both sides. Yes, ballot measure, title, shopping, that's an unfortunate game. And I can say that because I don't play that game. I've got 5 petitions I'm working on right now. The first one I filed. We got the ballot title. Done. The second one was a different topic. We got the ballot title. Done. Third one, got a ballot title. Wasn't working. That is, the content wasn't working. So we stopped and came up with a different concept, which will soon be filed. The fourth one, we got a ballot title. Excuse me, we applied for a ballot title. And the Attorney General, Secretary of State said, violates the Armada principles. We read their decision. Okay, we rewrote it and filed another version, which is now in the ballot title process. Now, the forces that want to oppose some of these measures regularly go to the Supreme Court to challenge the Attorney General's ballot title. I have never challenged an Attorney General's ballot title because I respect the process. I think they do a professional job. I take that back. Once I did, when they contacted me and they said they made a clerical mistake. They attached the wrong ballot title to their certification, and they had no power to correct the mistake. So that's something you should address. So we had to start all over again to get the ballot title that they wanted. And I take it back. In fact, the alternative was we went to the Supreme Court to say, they made a mistake. They admit the mistake. Please correct it. We're waiting for that decision. So that's the kind of stuff that's going on in this process. The 25 signature requirement, that's not too tough, and I have to acknowledge that. But a 10,000 signature requirement going through this process, we're required to deal with these ballot titles. But I ask you to consider, why do we have the ballot titles as part of this process anymore? What if you have a short ballot measure that's 25 words long or 50 words long? You're required to go through this whole process to have a ballot title, a yes statement, no statement, summary, and put it out there and wait for all of that. What if you were willing to simply go forward with a very short measure and say, that's what it says. In fact, why shouldn't that actually, these days with vote by mail, be put on the ballot rather than the ballot title? Some would argue, well, you could have a piece that distorts what it really does, and so there are arguments about that, but I'm raising those questions. What I'm coming around to, though, the 10,000 signature requirement, I think, doesn't get us there. If it's the cost, make the petitioners pay a filing fee. We make people pay to get in the voter's pamphlet. We make them pay to file for office or come in with lots of signatures. $1,000, $2,000 filing fee. A reasonable filing fee is a better way, I think, to reduce the tendency to shop, because then you're paying the price for shopping and you're paying the cost to the system. From the figures I heard, $2,000 would probably do the trick. At the same time, if you want to show a little more citizen concern and support of a petition, require 100 signatures. There are a lot of other details in this bill, though, that are very problematic. For instance, saying that you have to say that you were right there with the person. You can't attest to a signature done in your presence. I've gone to many a union hall where a petition's being passed around and the person at the front of the room knows all his brothers and sisters and is willing to attest at the end to the validity of their signatures. And we'd be saying, no, you can't do that. You've got to be sitting right next to them. That's a concern. There's a legitimate concern that you heard about this morning in regard to persons who engage in forgery or fraud or identity theft being able to be petition circulators. And that question came up in the context of, well, we're dealing with the paid circulators. What about the volunteers? This opens up a tremendous can of worms on the volunteer side as well as on the paid circulator side. Why not make it clear that anyone that's been convicted may not do this and that that's a crime? And at the same time, allow circulators to have prompt access to the criminal records check process, authorize them to do it, but don't run them through this registration process with the Secretary of State. Because when you start registering petition circulators in one context, what difference does it make between being a paid signature gatherer and a volunteer? There's a question of equitable application of the law here, and why should the volunteer be able to circulate without restriction and registration and the paid circulator have to register with the Secretary of State? You're going to have to come up with a very strong government principle to make that distinction. My suggestion is don't go that route. Make sure that you have a prohibition on people with these certain convictions doing this. Require those who hire people to run a background check, and that will help deal with the process. But the approach you're taking on this being proposed in this amended version of the bill, I think, is untoward. And again, there are other ways to achieve this without those kinds of complications. I don't want to run on because time is short for the committee this morning. I'm happy to work with staff if you would like some ideas about refining some of the other language. At right now, though, I have to say that the amendment package or the original bill, you always weigh it. If it's done this way, I'd say it does a lot more bad things than good things for the process in terms of citizen access. If you want to address the issues that roll in here, I think a lot more needs to be done to come up with a smooth bill that's fair to all concerned. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. It sounds like you do agree that some change is needed, though.
Madam Chair, I agree that change can always improve the system, but some changes can also degrade the system, and I see both in this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you. Kevin, pursue this a little further in terms of what you're suggesting that is different than the bill, and I admit I haven't read all the details of this complex bill, but instead of a registration system through the Secretary of State, you would just have a statutory prohibition that anyone circulating a petition in Oregon cannot have a conviction within the last 5 years. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I would add to that a requirement that if you're hiring somebody, that you then have to do a background check with the state police and an authorization for the state police to promptly give you that criminal background report, so that there's no delay there. And if you tie that together, then those who are paying do have an extra standard to bear in terms of checking. But then once they've gotten that verification of no criminal record, they should be allowed to proceed. If it turns out there was a hidden conviction they didn't know about, that's another story.
Okay, and then at the same time... I'm sorry. And then at the same time, you would take out the provisions in here that says that every paid petitioner has to register with the Secretary of State.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, absolutely. If you're in a tight timeline situation, that's the one time you're more likely than ever to use paid circulators. And there's fluctuations in the market, so to speak, and it would take time to be able to get people through that process. But I also simply don't like the idea of government registering anybody who's engaging in the civic process. We do register our voters, but that's to confirm that they are our voters. And we have a lot of debate about what they have to go through in order to register. Now we're throwing another burden in front of people that are willing to circulate petitions. Even if they're doing it for pay, I disagree with that.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. I guess kind of a two questions.
Okay.
One relates to what I don't know if you're here when Senator Atkinson gave testimony regarding timelines between when you get a ballot title and when you actually have, I guess, validity of signatures. Do you think that would be helpful to extend that, one? And then what do you think of the AG's proposal in concept, not necessarily the number of signatures? I just wonder what you think of his concept.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, first of all, as to the timelines, I think the ultimate deadlines are good, and I don't think the petition should be allowed to be carried over to the next biennium where you grandfather in the signatures. People are signing for that election for that issue, and so much can happen in the interim that I haven't seen a problem with the process in terms of the ultimate deadline. In fact, what I think we should encourage is another date or two. Right now you can file early in May and get some early verification, maybe a couple of earlier dates to get verification, because that system has varied so much in recent years. If you really want to have a real sense of how close you are to the target, the May deadline gets you very close to the July deadline, and maybe one earlier deadline of, say, January or February to get in the door. But carrying over into another biennium, I think, frankly, is not necessary. You can always conjure up the case where an issue arose in June and you couldn't make it by July. Well, then wait until November and start the cycle for 2 years later. That's my view on that. And I'm sorry, you had a second question.
It had to do with the concept presented by previous testimony from the Attorney General's office.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I want to say again, I've actually told the Attorney General's office that, contrary to what some other people think, I think they do a very professional job, and I admire the work that they do. And all except for one clerical error, I've actually not challenged their ballot titles in the court, because I think we had a fair process and they came out with a reasonable statement of what we were trying to do. So let's respect that and understand it. They seem to have brought up two problems. One is the volume, and the other is the cost. I think the cost can be addressed through a filing fee. The volume could be addressed through a combination of filing fee and some initial signature requirement, but I think the amount they're asking for is extraordinary, because sometimes they may have a different view of, and I'm not saying I've had a difference of perspective, but someone else may really think they didn't get it. And remember, the Supreme Court standard of review is close enough for government work. That is, the Supreme Court won't redo it and achieve perfection. The Supreme Court will simply, generally these days, just say, you didn't get it right, try again. That process doesn't necessarily give you a ballot title that you always think covers what you were trying to do. And so saying that you're going to make someone take the chance of going out and getting 10,000 signatures and then finding out, wow, we really got screwed with this ballot title, that bothers me. I do think you could add on some requirements at the beginning of the process, as I said earlier, but I think what they're proposing doesn't do the trick. And I also don't think the ballot title process at the end of this is a good idea. I think people need to know what government views this measure to be doing early on in the process to know what they're dealing with. And again, over 17 years now, I really don't think the Attorney General has been political about this. I think they've tried very hard to be lawyers and to do their job within those constraints.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you.
And we will certainly look forward to your ideas in the future. And next, I just wanted to ask committee members if you can hang in here for a little while after 10 o'clock, because we do have a number of people signed up to testify, and I'm not sure they can all make it back at a future hearing. So if possible, that would be great. Next, I'll call Ellen Lowe.
Thank you.
morning.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I was chief petitioner on Measure 26, the ban on payment per signature. And some have talked about the history of the initiative process in Oregon, and I've been part of that history now for over 55 years. I really do appreciate the opportunity to acknowledge the outstanding work that has been done in crafting the amendments to House Bill 2082, and I support what you are offering. This bill, as amended in its common sense provisions, will update and modernize the rules relating to the initiative system to address the way too many firms are trying to maneuver around following the law. And hopefully for the petitions that are currently circulating or about to be circulating for the 2008 ballot, we will not see so many media reports of fraud or the need for so many investigations. I really do believe that these amendments will enhance the likelihood of valid signatures rather than interfering with the citizen process of direct democracy. Now, I brought with me today, and you have now at your desks, a stark example of some of the problems we see on petition sheets from every county in Oregon on nearly every initiative petition that was circulated in 2006, from the spending cap to campaign finance reform. And these three sheets were supposedly circulated by a person named Shelley, and I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, Teedy, of White City, Oregon. But compare the signatures at the bottom of all three sheets, and you will see that they don't match at all. Shelley Teedy did not actually circulate and witness all three of these seats. And you'll see examples of similar instances in the boxes for nearly every petition. And that is why we really do need to hold signature gatherers and their chief petitioners more accountable. For if the real Shelley Teedy had to register and carry an identification badge, voters could have faith that their signatures are in safe hands from someone who wants to understand and follow the law. Now, unfortunately, there's another problem with Shelley Teedy, for she has a forgery conviction. And I strongly believe that people who have, that they do have the power and most often do rehabilitate themselves. And I support them as they try to do so. But somehow I think it's inappropriate to put them in the way of temptation immediately after they have paid their penance. And that is why I do support, along with the witness you heard from the state police, the provisions in these amendments that would keep people with forgery or identity theft convictions from gathering signatures and asking voters for their personal information. It's just common sense. The final problem on these three signature sheets is that even a quick glance will tell you that the three sheets were filled out by someone other than the voter. It's clear from the matching handwriting on each line, and you look at the obviously the same pen in some instances, and looking at these sheets paints a very clear picture to anyone who has encountered a signature gatherer on the street. Those who are getting paid per signature really don't want to give us time to complete every line. They want to rush us into signing anywhere from 2 to 8 petitions. And then they or someone they hire, perhaps at 10 cents per line, will fill in the rest of the information. The provision of HB 2082-1 to ban circulators from completing the petitions out of sight and out of mind of the voters will not only take away the incentive to rush and mislead, but will make it easier to detect forgeries. And I'm confident that the exemptions for signers who are disabled, that will ensure that every signature can be counted. I also provided to you a list of a few criminal records of top signature gatherers, and I wish to say that this came just from a random spot check of 10 professional signature gatherers, so it was just the beginning. Now, these are those sheets that I provided to you are just 3 out of hundreds of thousands that were submitted in 2006. But they tell an important story of the fraud that we continue to see and will continue to see until the Secretary of State is given more and better tools to investigate and until signature gatherers and their chief petitioners are held more accountable. I thank you for the work that you've done, and I encourage you to proceed with this piece of legislation with your amendments, because, again, I don't think it's interfering with citizens. I think it's making it more clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. I appreciate your testimony. And I agree that, you know, we don't want to encourage people that are up to no good, going out there and getting people's information. And maybe this is a question more for the Secretary of State's office. I'm wondering, why would we have to have somebody's complete address and street and number and not just a county? But I'll wait till you're up here. Before I forget, I just wanted to throw that out there.
And they will be tested.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm just wondering if maybe if you ban somebody from, other than the signer, from filling in this information, I think that could possibly raise hurdles for people. I'll just tell you about my husband, who's brilliant, but he can't spell his way out of a paper bag, nor can he write legibly. I'm his scribe. We go to the doctor, I'm filling out his form, he's signing it. I mean, that's the way it is, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, and I just feel like that. First of all, whoever ended up trying to read his information would be at a great disadvantage, or he would not be counted, and that would concern me. And I just wondered what your comments might be on that.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I have a brother, a physician who fits the description you just provided of your husband, but you see, when he registered to vote, he did it in his handwriting. And so the same degree of legibility and perhaps misspelling would have been there in his voter registration, so it would have matched. And as someone who was taught to cursive when she was 3 years old, my handwriting is pretty consistent.
Follow-up?
Well, I guess my follow-up would be his signature. Well, we won't even talk about that. But I'm talking about the fact that printing his name out or the street and all that, he probably could spell that right, but it wouldn't be very legible. And that's what I'm talking about. The information beyond the signature. Obviously, the signature is required to match. That's the law. But I'm just wondering about the rest of the information.
And Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, that you also complete when you register to vote.
Thank you. Another follow-up.
But that's not being looked at when you're looking at signatures at the county clerk's office. You're looking at the signature. You're not looking at the whole form that the person filled out, is my understanding. So you wouldn't be able to match, you know. And I don't think that it's required that the person who's registering to vote fill out all that information. They just have to sign it and attest to it.
And Representative Thatcher, we will have the Secretary of State again, and they can probably respond to that for you. So,
thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next, let's hear from Dan Meek. Good morning.
Good morning. I have distributed written copies of 5 pages of testimony that I also distributed to some members of the committee earlier, and I see that some of the provisions that I objected to have been stricken from House Bill 2082. I haven't commented on House Bill 2081, as that wasn't noticed for hearing, but now it appears that most of the provisions of 2081 have been melded into 2082 in the National Amendments, and I hope that you'll have future hearings to allow comments on those new provisions that weren't noticed for hearing. I won't be able to come back next week, however, because I'll be out of town. A couple of comments on the new provisions about ID theft. You might ask the Secretary of State if there are any instances known to the Director of Elections of ID theft being perpetrated by someone collecting signatures on a measure. I don't think there have been reported instances. Nevertheless, if someone has been convicted of ID theft or forgery, I believe that person should be banned from collecting signatures for life, or at least 20 years. So let's get serious about it and really do something about it. Mrs. Lowe, Ellen Lowe, has not provided her examples to us, so I really can't comment on those specific examples, except that I know that the Shelley TD sheets were thrown out by the Secretary of State and those signatures weren't counted. So if there's a problem, the Secretary of State already addressed that, because the Secretary of State's office looks at the signatures of the circulators. It requires folks to submit exemplars of the signatures of circulators. And they tossed out, as I recall, several hundred sheets on various petitions of Shelley Teedy. So the sheets that Ms. Lowe provided to you were quite simply not counted as valid at all to begin with. I'd like to start on the 2082 provisions in reverse order. Let's start with the official template part. By requiring that the only sheets you can circulate be those that are printed by the Secretary of State and sequentially numbered, means that sheets cannot go from person to person or neighbor to neighbor on the basis of spontaneous interest. If you want to collect a signature from someone, you can't merely photocopy both sides of a blank sheet and start collecting signatures. You have to somehow obtain the official sheet from the Secretary of State or the chief petitioner somewhere in the state. So I think that discourages spontaneous volunteer efforts. In addition, as was pointed out by Representative Greenlich and by former Senator Mannix, it would preclude distribution of signature sheets by the Internet. We've had experience doing that. Of course, it's difficult because currently signature sheets must be printed on the back of cover sheets. So you must instruct persons to download 2 PDF files and to print them back to back. I would note, however, that Representative Greenlich stated that he took signature sheets that came to him that did not have the cover sheet on the back and photocopy the cover sheets on the back. Unfortunately, that's a violation of Oregon election law that is punishable by a fine of $125,000 and 5 years in jail. That indicates what we're dealing with here, that even someone whom you would expect to have the greatest amount of knowledge and experience in legislative matters has really admitted that he committed an untold number of absolute undeniable election law violations. Ellen Lowe, for example, herself filed complaints of alleging such election law violations against the chief petitioners of every measure that made the ballot in the last cycle, except the one that was supported by a group called Our Oregon. She had press conferences with Our Oregon to announce these complaints. These complaints are pending against, among others, vice chairman of this committee. And those complaints were filed to the Secretary of State 11 months ago and 8 months ago. The Secretary of State has not resolved any of them. So if you're going to want to clean up the initiative process, one thing to do is let's have some timelines for the resolution of complaints that are filed to the Secretary of State instead of allowing anyone to file a complaint, no matter how baseless it is, and then be able to say, as the opponents of our measure said throughout the campaign, that we are now under investigation for severe election law violations. That's true. Everyone is under investigation as soon as a complaint is filed with the Secretary of State, whether it has any validity or not. The other thing I don't understand about the official template, and by the way, our experience is that we did get some signature sheets back, one-sided, that were printed on the internet. We had to throw them away. But we got back hundreds of them that were correctly filled out and two-sided, and this measure would preclude that from happening. And I certainly agree with Mr. Mannix that we should have a sheet that you can post on the internet that is a one-sided sheet and only requires one signature by a voter, a single sheet, so a voter can actually sign it without needing to sign it twice and without being subject to the incredibly complex rules on circulator certification and dating. Representative Greenlee briefly mentioned. I also watched the Secretary of State's process for looking at the circulator certificates, and I saw sheets that were thrown out which had been filled out by legislators and former members of this body as circulators. However, they did not correctly fill out the circulator certification, and so those sheets were thrown out. So I think the official template requirement doesn't make sense. Also, if the signature sheets are sent out sequentially numbered, they won't come back sequentially numbered. And right now, there's a requirement that when they come back to the Secretary of State's office, they be sequentially numbered by county. If that serves a purpose, then that purpose is defeated by the official template requirement that they be sequentially numbered when they go out into the field, because inevitably, then they won't be sequentially numbered when they come back. On the paid circulator registration and training requirement, apparently the training requirement is now deleted. On the registration requirement, I believe that has already been found unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999 when it was attempted in Colorado. On the no-writing provision, what the no-writing provision would do, as I believe Representative Thatcher recognized, is make the validity of a voter's signature dependent upon the legibility of his or her hand-printing abilities. Right now, what the Secretary of State checks is the signature. The other information on the sheet, on the line, is only to try to identify in the voter registration files who that signature belongs to. After looking at hundreds of thousands of signatures, my belief is that most people's signatures are illegible. You cannot tell the name of the person from the signature. So then you go to the next item, which is the printed name. A large number of people print their names also illegibly. This bill would make those signatures invalid because the names would be illegible. What we did in several ballot measure campaigns since 1978 is when we get sheets and we see that both the signature and the printed name is illegible, we have volunteers go to the county election offices and look up the voter registration record, the computerized voter registration records. Of course, in Marion County, they weren't computerized for a long time. Look up the records. And if we can find that, we look it up by address, and then carefully print in legibly the name of the voter in the space for printed name above the illegible printed name. Then if that signature is selected by random sample for verification, the county election official can read the name. If you can't read the name, either the printed name or the signed name, election officials often don't take the time to look it up by address, and they're not actually required to look it up by address. Many of these signatures, in fact, in the last cycle, we found out that all of our signatures in Multnomah County were checked by temporary employees. All of the full-time employees of Multnomah County were at luncheons sponsored by election machine manufacturing companies. So I don't see why we should require... We should penalize someone for having illegible hand printing. It also, of course, is another gotcha which will disqualify signatures collected by volunteers. Already, if you're a volunteer, you have to follow a full page of instructions that's on the back of every signature sheet, and that isn't even one-tenth of the instructions that you have to follow in order to correctly have your folks fill out the sheet and to correctly certify your own signature at the bottom. If a volunteer happens to make a mistake and say, Well, here's a husband and wife, and the wife wrote in the address legibly, and the husband used quotation marks underneath it. Well, there's a Secretary of State rule that bans that. So in order to say that signature, maybe the volunteer circulator said, well, okay, I know that the ditto marks aren't allowed because the sheet says ditto marks aren't allowed, so I will print in the address of the husband as the same address as the wife. And then you've invalidated at least the husband's signature. You may have invalidated the entire signature sheet because this, under the bill, it is not clear what the sanction is for having a signature sheet upon which there are anyone has written information about a voter, except the voter him or herself. Now, there's this provision in here about you can assist disabled voters. Well, there's no definition of disabled in the bill. There's no way to document that any request for assistance has been made. And I don't believe that there is any recognized definition of disabled that says someone who has illegible handprinting is disabled. Nevertheless, this bill would disqualify the signatures of persons with illegible handprinting. And finally, you know, it does offer an opportunity for sabotage. Because there are folks out there who are, of course, opposed to any measure that would be on the ballot, and there are folks who are opposed to the initiative process itself. And this, of course, applies not only to the initiative, but also to referenda and referral and recalls. Under this bill, instead of sending out blockers to block the signature on sheets, opponents could send out signers. People who would say, yes, I'm interested in signing, and I will sign your sheet, and I'm going to use... If the signatures on the sheet, let's say, are mostly in black ink, I'm going to use green ink or blue ink. And I'm just make a couple of stray marks. Under this bill, that could invalidate the entire sheet and all of the signatures on the sheet because the bill says any obscuring of any information about the voter makes something invalid, either the sheet invalid or that signature invalid. So it would offer an opportunity for quick and an untraceable sabotage.
But what would prevent that right now?
What prevents it now is that, Madam Chairman, is that if someone puts a line through an address or any information or the printed name, that doesn't disqualify the signature.
But there certainly are other means of... I mean, we hear stories of people going out collecting signatures and then throwing them away, and people think they've signed, but... The signatures were never turned in, so
well,
certainly sabotage is a real
that
problem.
That would require the circulator to be the saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying is this allows anyone who signs the petition to become an untraceable saboteur. There are many other reasons that are presented in my written testimony that I believe that this would not be a good idea. It would disenfranchise folks. It would prevent the petition circulators from simply providing information to county election officials to allow them to verify valid signatures. And I don't see any reason for it. And I hope that I can come back. I hope you will schedule a hearing on the other types of petitions sometime after next week. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for your comments. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meek, do you care to comment briefly about the title shopping aspect, the 10% proposal for signatures?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Vice Chair Buckley. Ballot title shopping is not something that any of the groups I'm associated with have done, probably to their detriment. Probably would have been a good idea, but so I'm I have probably less objection to that than others may have. In past sessions, there have been bills that would require circulation first with the Attorney General summary, and then require the process to stop for an indefinite period of time, at least 1 month, perhaps 4 or 5 months, depending upon Supreme Court review. And then to start again with entirely new signature sheets, and with all signatures thereafter collected on the old sheets invalid, which I think would particularly be complicated for volunteer efforts, and I've opposed that. So it looks like some of the objectionable provisions of past bills have been removed. If all signatures can be collected with the Attorney General summary, then you don't have to stop in the middle and wait for the ballot title process, and that's an improvement over past bills. My concern would be the unreviewability of the ballot title summary prepared by the Attorney General. And perhaps there would be a process to allow a very quick review, perhaps by a circuit court, of the Attorney General's summary for circulation. Right now, for example, ballot titles on local measures are reviewed by circuit courts, and circuit court review is final, and it happens very quick, and it happens, ordinarily happens very quickly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. And next, we'll call Ted Blazak. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair and honored representatives, my name is Ted Blazak. In 1999, I founded and am currently the president of Democracy Resources, a professional signature gathering company here in Oregon. House Bill 2082 is, in my view, an excellent bill. It would not in any way undermine the ability of citizens to place initiatives on the ballot. Instead, it establishes a cleaner and more accountable signature gathering process. It will help restore citizen confidence in the initiative process. These proposed rules will not be difficult to comply with, and I can say that with a great deal of confidence because it's almost exactly what I've been doing for the past 8 years. Any ballot measure campaign with any level of decent organization should be able to follow both the letter and the spirit of Measure 26 while placing numerous initiatives on the ballot. Initiative Integrity Act, which was supported by 75% of the voters, is the overarching law that guides paid signature gathering efforts in Oregon. What I think you're doing here today is to uphold that law. Last year, I and we all did saw a lot of media accounts of misrepresentation, fraud, violations of Measure 26, and staff getting robbed of their proper pay. This bill will go a long way towards ending such shady business practices. To address some specific provisions of the bill, the overall theme I noticed from them from the perspective of a signature gathering company is that they are really actually very little steps. They seem mainly to improve the public record keeping by signature gathering efforts so that companies like mine are able to demonstrate compliance with the law. For example, regarding the requirement to keep payroll evidence as proof of compliance with Measure 26, I have an excellent payroll service. It's just simply impossible to run a paid signature gathering effort without an accurate payroll process. That's just such a large part of any initiative campaign, it's a given. So to have payroll records available takes no great effort. To the provision that requires circulators to register with the state and wear ID badges. All of my staff currently wear photo ID badges, and our phone numbers are listed on them. I do this because it gives voters confidence and security when they sign a petition. It's a way for the voter to contact the campaign independent of the individual petition circulator, a way for them also to lodge a complaint or seek more information. And it is also a very simple and easy thing to do with digital photography and a good printer. We make the ID badges instantly. Most importantly, it makes it possible to and very clear to the voting public that the law is being enforced and that the process is being monitored. This is a vital tool that you're giving the Secretary of State's office to enforce the law. Additionally, it will be very easy to comply with background checks. They are convenient and inexpensive. In this day and age, voters will rest more comfortably knowing that their participation in this democratic process is now less likely to put them at risk. Relating to the provision that only the voter will be allowed to fill in the petition sheet, I've never encountered that to be a problem. 98% of the voters, when they're signing a petition, will continue to fill out the address automatically. It's not something we have to ask them to do or ask them to dictate it to us to record. From where I am sitting, the only people, the people most likely to oppose this legislation are those who haven't complied to Measure 26 fully in the past 4 years and aren't aware of the fact that it's not difficult to do. They're just held on to an outdated model, and I just don't understand a lot of the opposition to this, actually. I don't understand people saying it's a difficult process. I also endorse a provision that requires Secretary of State's office to prepare the office templates. Quite frankly, that's simply a bureaucratic procedure where I, on behalf of the campaign, provide them with the PDF file and the document. They edit it. They give it back to me. I bring it to them. We go back and forth until every comma is in its place. Quite frankly, it's like turning in a term paper. And if they're just going to do it for you, it'll speed things up for the signature gathering effort. In conclusion, I'd like to add that as a signature gatherer, I welcome these rules, for they make it they make a very clear format from which I can easily and publicly demonstrate that we are following all the election laws and protecting our employees. I think this will allow voters to sign a petition with peace of mind that they are participating in democratic practice of clarity and integrity. One last comment is Ellen Lowe asked me to pass on to you before she left and to correct a statement from Mr. Meek. Her evidence that she submitted the copies of the petition sheets were from the state elections office, which and they were counted to certify the measure, apparently.
Thank you. Questions? Vice Chair Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bezek, thank you for your testimony. On the issue of the address line or someone completing that in terms of being eligible, would you be comfortable if the provision said instead of someone who's disabled, trying to that definition, but that a signature gatherer could fill that in on the request of the voter? I'm worried about Representative Farr's husband very much.
I'm not really.
Senator Thatcher, sir.
I'm not too worried about it, but just so you have a little bit of the background, when we see this occur, it occurs when a circulator is carrying like 7 or 8 different petition sheets, and the voter will sign the top sheet, and the voter themselves will fill out the address, and then the circulator, this is the common practice, will say, okay, now just sign the rest, and don't worry about filling them in, I'll do that, because they're goal is to get as many signatures as possible, as quickly as possible, with not necessarily presenting the full petition to the person or doing so as briefly as possible and to expedite the process, because no one wants to stand there for 20 minutes reviewing them all. That has never been a problem for us, because we usually are only carrying 1 or 2 petitions at a time.
Can I follow?
Follow up.
My apologies, sir, Representative Thatcher. Representative Holdy and I get confused all the time. My apologies on that one. Mr. Bezek, in terms of the template, you've worked with campaigns that have combined volunteer signatures with your company's signatures.
Every campaign I've worked with.
And do you have any concern about the cases where a volunteer will Xerox a sheet, they'll give it to their next-door neighbor, because they're so enthusiastic about getting signatures for this campaign?
It's a rather rare occurrence. When like when Representative Greenlick spoke earlier about having to have like 140,000 signatures,
right,
in order, that's a natural thing, because so many people will sign believing they're registered to vote and they won't, so you have to create what's called a buffer. And for other errors such as circulator error, the voter signs the wrong address or things like that, that is one of those things, but it's a very minute. I haven't had that be a significant problem at all for us.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Blazak, you have a signature gathering company, if I understand correctly, and I'm just wondering how many initiatives have you been given to petition for, referendums or whatever, and how many have made it to the ballot?
I have gathered the signatures, the great bulk of the signatures necessary for initiative to be placed on the ballot on 15 occasions, and only one of those that was submitted failed to make it on the ballot. And
that wasn't my fault.
Yes, and on the one that failed, what was the reason it failed?
There were several reasons for that. There was a large amount of duplication of the volunteer signatures. There was a the campaign itself played it too close to the edge on how many signatures they submitted, and there not being enough of a buffer. And then there was also I actually disagreed with the verification process of those signatures at that particular campaign. I thought that it was faulty.
And that leads me to my third question.
Okay,
thank you. The verification process.
Yes.
It could have put you back over the edge where you didn't
qualify. Exactly. This particular.
And so there
campaign.
Are problems with some of the technicalities that are required by the Secretary of State's office for particular.
Well, this was
state
a city measure. So this wasn't a statewide measure.
Not a statewide measure.
Right.
But so this wasn't. This wasn't a requirement or verification process set forth by the Secretary of State's office, is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, Oregon, there's Oregon state law and then there's city law, and when you're gathering signatures for a city or a county measure,
okay,
you have to adhere to both of them. There's some particular standards for the city and county that aren't necessarily the same as the state. But, I mean, in general, you're right. So,
Representative Roebling.
Yeah, just since you do this, thank you, Madam Chair. The electronic issue about having an ability for an individual voter to download a deal and sign it and send it in.
Right.
Is that something that you think that we should consider?
Or do you know, I really don't have a strong opinion on that at all. It's not something I do.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I'd like to, we will not be able to get through all the witnesses that we have signed up, and we will be hearing this again on Friday. Is there anyone here today that cannot come back on Friday?
I can't come on Friday. Are you ready to do it Monday?
And we will also have a hearing on Monday. But, so would you like to testify in the remaining time?
No, I really want
no,
to.
I, no, that's fine.
I think you can.
Sure. How about in the back there?
Yes.
Sarah Nishi?
Yes.
Okay, come on forward. And this will be our last witness for today, and we will be coming back at least Friday and Monday. And I would ask committee members, if possible, if you could look at your schedule and see if you may be able to hang in there again until 10:30 on our next
hearing. Would you like to start at 8 on Friday? Is that a way to...
No, that's an idea.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Would that be
too late.
Better?
Too late. It's already been posted.
Too late. Committee administrator says that's too late.
We can't post it. We could.
You don't mean it's too late in the morning.
We could do it for Monday, but we couldn't do it for Monday.
I don't want to do it for Monday.
You can't give 48 hours notice.
Yes.
For that, is what you're saying. Right. So I guess
that'd be wrong.
That's a great idea for Monday. We can consider that.
In the future, we can consider that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you so much for staying a little bit late this morning to hear my testimony on this matter. Again, my name is Sarah Nashif. I am the former campaign manager for Initiative 51, which became Measure 43, which is the parental notification measure on the ballot in November in 2006. Little background, we required 75,630 signatures required to qualify for the ballot. We submitted 115,845 signatures for verification process, and we had a total of 94,407 signatures validated, which is one of the highest validation rates that Oregon has ever seen in the initiative process history. That's an 84% validity rate. It's actually a 93% validity rate because they automatically throw out almost 10% just kind of off the top. So when out of the 1,000 sample, that is a 93% validity rate. This is well above the average in 2006 election, since most of the other initiatives had only 65% to 70% validity rate. The Secretary of State's office even went so far as to use our campaign as an example in their press release to demonstrate the simplicity of the initiative process in the state of Oregon. However, I would like to give my own reasons for our successful initiative process. The reason Measure 43 had such a high validity rate was our campaign went so far as to mail back Oregonians their petition sheets that did not meet the Secretary of State's standards, asking them to fix the problem. Or we would send them a new petition sheet, giving them opportunity to sign again. Measure 43 spent a lot of money in making sure that no voter was disenfranchised because of these bureaucratic rules. I have a misprint right there. It's not 18,000, it's 28,000 signatures were disqualified because of circulator error on our side of it, whether it's a lot of many of the issues that have been mentioned before, people photocopying, not understanding why they can't photocopy it at home, the confusion of the dating later at the bottom. I mean, there's numerous issues that are just making a initials, you know, what's okay on your check to initial, you have to fully sign according to the Secretary of State's office. That really confused a lot of people. And it is a confusing process because even with the second attempt, many voters did not send them back again because of they're just confused by the instructions. Again, I thought the analogy of making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich was very adequate example. But ultimately, we never submitted these sheets to the Secretary of State's office in order to keep our validity rate up, but lowering our signature turn-in, wanting to respect the process that has been set forth by the legislature and the Secretary of State's office. Nevertheless, 3,000 petition sheets were never submitted, and another 10,000 signatures, and this is approximation, were never submitted for reference by the Secretary of State's office. What these numbers represent in my mind is the number of Oregon voters disenfranchised by the current Oregon initiative process. 10,000 people did not get a say on this particular ballot measure. And thousands of voters did not have the same luxury that I had to get paid to study the rules set forth by the Secretary of State's office. And they did not get sufficient petition sheet adequately to be counted. I would like to testify this morning against House Bill 2082 because I believe it would bog down the process even more so as to make participation in the initiative process by the average voter virtually impossible. And not only would it seriously impede the ability of voters to navigate the initiative process, it would force the initiative process into the hands of professional politicians. And that is a lot of these companies that have been, you know, speaking up today. Let me explain a little bit better by looking specifically at two items. First, the statement in the last paragraph of the summary prohibits persons other than persons authorized by the chief petitioner from obtaining signatures. Measure 43 had over 20,000 circulators. We were a volunteer campaign. Less than 5% of those less than 1% of our circulators were paid, and less than 5% of the total signatures that we gained were from paid circulators. So it would have been virtually impossible for our two chief petitioners, one of which worked two jobs and the other which was a Portland State student and worked a part-time job, for them to approve of all 20,000 circulators. They would have been forced to go the paid petitioner route and narrowing down people that could spend full-time work to gathering signatures. There is no way they would have the time or the energy to approve 20,000 circulators to the Secretary of State's office. Basically, you're forcing the hand for them into the hands of people that have money and the time to go along with what these standards you're asking for. The average people would not be able to collect signatures in their workplaces, churches, or their kids' baseball games without first gaining approval from the government. I think this is a very scary perspective on this, that we must, you know, register people in order for participation in what is a grassroots, should be a grassroots movement. Therefore, we would be sufficiently taking the process out of Oregonians' hands and into the hands of outsiders and wage earners. And then secondly, looking at the first sentence in the summary, which says prohibits persons other than the person signing signature sheet from writing, altering, or obscuring information about persons signing the signature sheet. You've heard lots of testimony about this. I have a little bit different perspective I would like to add to that, in that we did a lot of the work for the Secretary of State's office, and I find it interesting that the Secretary of State wants to put this in there, because I think they're generating a lot of work from themselves. Like, we would go look up addresses and make sure that everything was, the most information was presented possible to the Secretary of State's office to increase our validation rate. We also went through and crossed off duplicates doing that work for the Secretary of State's office for them as well. We would cross off dates off petition sheets that had wrong dates, and we did a lot of work in order to save as many signatures as we can and to keep the sheet as valid as possible. We would obscure information in order to allow the most number of signatures to be counted. Ultimately, House Bill 282 takes the initiative process from complicated to impossible. Ultimately, what purpose does House Bill 2082 serve? The only consequence I can see would be to put the initiative process in the hands of the wealthy and the elite. People will find a way to get through, but are these the people that we want involved in the process? And why should either of these be our goals? We should be proud of the tradition and initiatives, Oregon. I was happy to hear Mr. Atkinson's testimony as well, Kevin Mannix, about the history and Oregon setting the precedent for initiatives, and it's a proud history. And it indicates a strong political activism by the Oregonians, and we should be proud of that activism and know many states would be happy to have the same level of involvement that we are happy to testify here about today. In closing, I would just say the Oregon initiative process is already tedious, expensive, and bureaucratic, and I'm a little bit offended by the last statement that says if you're smart enough, you should be able to get through it. I am smart enough and put a very, very strategic system in place for collecting those number of signatures and to prevent with the utmost integrity every signature for validation I truly believe should have been counted. And did not commit any level of fraud in the process as well. I was a little horrified by that testimony as well. But all that to say, I have a huge, huge respect for the process. And our campaign overcame these obstacles and other obstacles allowed to allow the public to address this particular issue of parental notification. And yet we still did not succeed to make it a law. Despite this, I continue to have the utmost respect for the initiative process. It is not partisan, and it does not play favorites. It allows both conservative and liberal perspectives an equal opportunity to be heard in the political process. And I believe the initiative process gets to the core of what American values really are, and that by hampering it, as you suggest today, would only serve to pit government against the people. Thank you very much for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
I'm sorry. I do have a couple of questions, and I know everybody's in a hurry to get out here, but I have two questions. One, how long did it take you to get fully schooled in the rules? And my second question would be, you mentioned at the top of your testimony that 10% of the signatures were just thrown off the top.
Yeah,
could you explain that a little bit?
I think it's 8%, I think, is the official, and that's in the guidelines right now. There's an assumption that there's that number of duplicates already in the system, so that's automatically thrown off the top, and then there's 1,000 sample taken, and then your validity rate is based on that 1,000 sample, and if it falls below, then they take a larger sample. That's the process for what it is right now.
Thank you. But the other question was how long did you take to get fully educated in the rules?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Me personally, about a month, and you'd be surprised how fast those details slip your mind when you're in the throes of a campaign like this and you're looking at petition sheets. So me and the people that worked with me spent, that was our Bible for several months, the rules that were printed by the Secretary of State's office. And then there's always the read between the lines ambiguousness that you're trying to figure out, well, what would the secretary say? And sometimes you look at something, this is common sense, but you know this isn't the letter of the law, so therefore it's not going to, what's common sense to your average person is not common sense to the Secretary of State's office.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Great,
that will
you.
Be our last witness for today. We will be taking this up again on Friday, and I will adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2082. And we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.